Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Just a note on our music selections this morning. Yesterday, we were playing music from Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne and other amazing music. And we mentioned that both Ellis Marsalis and Bucky Pizzarelli had passed away. We are going to be playing music from them. We just heard from Ellis Marsalis. We'll do three from him in the beginning and then have Bucky Pizzarelli at the end. So we thank you very much for people who wrote in and gave us some ideas, and we thank you. And again, it's sad that we have to play the music under these circumstances, but we just want to remind you and have a moment to remember the greatness of these individuals who died of this horrible virus. We welcome you to join us in the discussion this morning. Panel at WAMC.org. It's Friday. I don't know that it matters anymore. Every day seems like Friday. It's just weird. But here we are, and we'll take it up and say it's Friday and be happy about it. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe.
Excellent. Is everything okay?
Everything is not okay. We are all sheltered in place.
Right.
Our mental health is suffering, and and we'll do our best to keep a good face on all of it.
That's right. That is our goal for today. Senior fellow and visiting professor of Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck is with us. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm good.
So nice to have you here, and I thank you for being with us. Also with us, President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Bruschetti. Good morning, Heather. Good morning, Heather.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Heather.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Hey.
How are you?
Hi, I'm okay, living in the land of mud right now. But,
yeah, it's mud season.
I'll get over it.
It is mud season.
Yes, it is.
And we welcome you. Also, we welcome Aaron Pasitti to the program, Siena College economics professor and our good friend. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. Doing as well as possible.
Excellent. That seems to be the rule of the day, if not this month, right? We're doing as well as possible. Panel at WAMC.org for your letters. We'd love to hear from you. As I've been telling you the last few days, we've been getting a ton of letters, so please keep your letter short and to the point. That way we can get to as many as possible. If we don't get to your letter, it's nothing personal. It's just that we're getting so many, we can't fit them all in, and we're just trying to get a smattering. Also, if you've save room for the other guy and girl and other folk. So, maybe one per customer, one a week or so. That's fine. We welcome you. And
one issue, Joe, if I may,
of course.
I may interfere here. I probably am saying more than I should, but we've been getting a lot of letters about the president abusing the amount of time he is taking on the air every night, not only from us our people who want to hear our regional news and the rest of it. So we've decided we will use him where appropriate. Do you want to carry on that, Joe?
Sure. It's going to be it's still available on our radio station. It's going to be available on HD2. And obviously it'll be embedded on our website.
Right. But, we truly believe the president of the United States has to be heard, whether we like him or not. And I don't. But the important thing here is that it's become abusive, and we're going to make sure that we take what's important and not what's not important. And there will be some who say, well, you shouldn't make that decision. Well, that's what news people do all the time, and we're doing it.
All right, let's go to the matters here of what we're going to talk about, and we have a lot to talk about. Who's typing, by the way?
Me.
Okay.
I'm stopping.
All right. Thank you very much. I feel like
don't do that.
I feel like I'm in.
Sorry.
I feel like I'm in court.
Don't do that.
Well, you kind of are.
Like a transcript is being done. Thank you very much. I apologize. I know everyone wants to multitask, but please.
All right. I'll fold the laundry now. it's quieter.
There you go. Or get one of those whisper keyboards. Okay. So here is, let's start off with this. a article in the Washington Post, Commander of Confusion, that that is the headline. Trump sows uncertainty and seeks to cast blame in coronavirus crisis. In the 3 weeks since declaring the novel coronavirus outbreak a national emergency, President Trump has delivered a dizzying array of rhetorical contortions, sowed confusion, and repeatedly sought to cast blame on others. History has never known a crisis response as strong as his own, Trump says, yet the self-described wartime president claims he is merely backup. He has faulted governors for acting too slowly and, as he did Thursday, accused overwhelmed state and hospital officials of complaining too much and of hoarding supplies. America is winning its war with the coronavirus, the president says, yet the death toll rises still. And in the best case scenario, more Americans will die than the wars in Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined. The economy is the strongest ever and will rebound in no time, he says, yet stock markets have created, have cratered, and in the past 2 weeks, a record 10 million people filed for unemployment insurance. As Trump has sought to remake his public image from that of a skeptic of the pandemic's danger to a savior forestalling catastrophe and protecting hundreds of thousands of people from a vicious contagion, he has also distorted the truth, making edits and creating illusions at many turns. That from an article, again, with the title Commander of Confusion by Philip Rucker and Robert Costa in The Washington Post. We should note at this point, over 1 million cases globally, nearly a quarter of a million cases, 245,573 in the United States alone, over 6,000 deaths in the United States. Those numbers as of this hour from Johns Hopkins University. Alan, I'll let you begin.
Well, the Shartocks are going to start to wear a mask. We were lucky enough to get a mask because people are saying it's a smart thing to do. As for the president, I have to say this. This guy is a liar. We've always known that he was a liar. We have tape of him saying it's nothing. We have tape of him saying, you know, it'll all be over by Easter. We have a tape of him saying, this is all a hoax, a Democratic hoax. And now he says he gets 10 out of 10 for performance. It is absolutely infuriating.
I will go to Judith Enk. Are you equally infuriated?
Yeah, completely. I mean, President Trump said he wants to be considered a wartime president. I think he's already lost the war, and he lost it in January, as Alan described. Yesterday, Governor Cuomo said New York has 6 days worth of ventilators left for hospitals. ProPublica did reporting saying that New York State is paying 15 times the normal price for medical equipment. We know there's not enough testing. And yet, the Trump administration is not fully utilizing the Defense Production Act. This is nothing new. This is a law that was passed in 1950 in response to the Korean War. It's part of a civil defense and war mobilization. And since 1950, Congress reauthorized it over 50 times. I just continued to be baffled that Trump and the person we were introduced to yesterday as being a key player here, Jared Kushner, God help us, are still not fully utilizing this very powerful tool that they have. And we know this is going to be going on for a very long time. This is not staying home for a few days for a blizzard. This is a long-term problem. Trump, he invoked the law, but he's not using it. And you think back to other war times, you know, Rosie Riveter, you know, people going to factories and transforming them into goods that were needed. We need, you know, I'm a woman of peace, but we need an actual wartime response to this. And Trump is saying he doesn't want to invoke it because private companies are taking care of things. This will nationalize these corporations. That's just wrong. the U.S. government is not going to purchase these companies. They're going to direct them to manufacture high priority products like ventilators. And then the companies are going to get paid by taxpayers for their product. I think, Joe, we need to really keep an eye on this Defense Production Act, because if it's not fully implemented, our worsening situation is going to get even worse. And in New York's case, it's probably too late to get more ventilators into hospitals. This is to deal with a long-term crisis.
To me, you asked one of the essential questions, which is, it defies explanation to me, and maybe there is a perfectly rational explanation, I just haven't heard it yet, which is, why wasn't that done a long time ago? As far as
I think we know. One is just the sheer incompetence of the Trump administration.
Yeah, but what's the rationale?
I think Trump did not want to acknowledge.
Did we lose Judith? All right.
Oh boy.
All right.
Well.
Go ahead,
I'll
Heather.
Jump in for
all right.
A second, if I could. First off,
she saw that hole in the mountain. She's driving the truck through. Go ahead.
I think there's a couple things that are being ignored. I think there's no doubt that we're seeing a huge contrast in leadership ability between our governor and the president, and the president not wanting to acknowledge that this was as big a problem as it was earlier. I mean, you can say the same of Congress, who were briefed on this in January and didn't do anything about it because they were focused on other things. And I think that is all unfortunate. I don't think that helps any of us move forward. And as far as getting to, commanding manufacturers to shift production, I think they're trying desperately. I've been on the phone for days with businesses who want to help. And it's a really unfortunate circumstance that all of our manufacturing, or not all of it, but a lot of our manufacturing, particularly of these medical goods, shifted overseas, in part because, in some instances, of bad policy that made it very difficult to affordably produce them in the United States. And I think after all of this, we're going to need to take a long, hard look at whether or not we need to pull back and not be so reliant on globalized manufacturing. New York is well positioned to do things like make these masks. We have a timber industry, but it's very hamstrung by some of the rules in the Adirondack Park. And I'm not saying they're not for good reason, but there could be more rational approach to allowing development. And we have water. I mean, we've got paper manufacturing in the state, but where we used to have manufacturing of these kinds of goods, they're not here anymore, and we need to fix that. We need to start focusing on how do we fix this, because this is not going to be the last pandemic, I think. And it's far from over. I mean, I think 2 weeks ago we were talking about it being in the first inning. I still feel like we're not out of the second.
I agree with you. I know Judith is back because I heard a deep sigh. Go ahead.
Yes. Sorry. I'm sorry. I just can't allow the notion that because of Adirondack Park Agency regulations that the timber industry can't produce masks. Most companies left the United States for one thing: cheap labor. And they moved around the globe to find where can they get workers to work for the least amount of money. And this is globalization. And I think Heather raises some very, very good points that when you have an international supply chain, you are stuck when you're in a situation like this. But it was the decision by Apple, for instance, to make their parts in China. It was, you know, clothing manufacturers were in Mexico, and then they went to Vietnam. It's nothing other than companies looking for the cheapest way to make their products.
I would just put an asterisk on that, because I talk to CEOs of manufacturing companies fairly regularly, and in paper particularly. The lack of environmental regulations elsewhere, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, but it has made it very difficult for them to compete. And, you know, in the U.S., We don't actually calculate the harm that comes with buying paper that is much cheaper, that is produced in another country, that is, you know, shipped here and has a huge carbon footprint, versus buying locally, where on the shelf it's slightly more expensive but much more responsibly produced.
Aaron.
Yeah, so just to tack on to what Heather and Judith were saying, is that this is a good time to reevaluate our place and relationship with the global economy. I think that, you know, as an economist, there are obviously gains from trade in terms of different nations producing different things that utilize their comparative advantage. But I think one thing this is highlighting is that there are certain goods and certain industries that should be better managed in the face of this pandemic, you know, pharmaceutical production, strategic goods for, you know, military and civilian use. So I think this is a good time to reevaluate this extremely sensitive global supply chain. It works really well when it works really well until it doesn't, and then it breaks down. I'm going to add two things to the topic that Joe brought up about the, you know, commander of confusion. From an economic point of view, this, you know, this waffling of, oh, it's a Chinese hoax, or it's, you know, just like the flu, all of this ultimately affects people's behavior, whether it gets them to travel more than they should be traveling, whether it gets them to travel less than they should be traveling. These mixed messages create a lot of uncertainty for individuals, which, like Alan pointed out, has mental health repercussions. But it also changes the behavior of firms. You know, when businesses are responding to extreme uncertainty, they tend to freeze. And if they feel the uncertainty building, firms could preemptively lay off workers, which only exacerbates the current unemployment problem. That reduces consumption, that reduces business investment. The complete lack of clarity on the small business loan program is a good example of this. This confusion has economic repercussions that are very real and are just going to multiply over the weeks and the months, if not the years ahead. The second reason, the second thing I wanted to say is,
give you a 1 minute warning, but go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I can answer this. I can do this in 1 minute. Why is Trump doing this? One, I think he's a narcissist and that he thinks it's all about him. So it's all about his primetime show every night. The second reason I think goes beyond Trump and kind of brings in the whole political establishment. One possible explanation for why he's doing this is to show that the government is ineffective. If you want the government to be ineffective, you do this. If you want the government to be effective,
that.
You... Yeah, I know. That's the point. You're sacrificing people for the Republican ideology that government is not effective at doing things. Or you can invoke the Defense Production Act and show that the government's really effective at doing things.
Yeah.
So you're sacrificing ideology, or you're sacrificing people and clarity to promote an ideology that benefits the elites.
Time is up, Aaron, but thank you very much. You did an excellent job in the time allotted. We'll be right back. Playing Ellis Marsalis, who passed away on Wednesday from the coronavirus. Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. We are glad that you're with us. Panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to get in with a letter, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We do have many letters. Does anybody want to respond to what Aaron said before we move on?
I want to mention one thing. You know, I think two positives that will come out of this pandemic are, one, a real respect for science, that you have to listen to scientists and medical experts when they sound the alarm. And there are parallels on the climate change issue. And then secondly, I think we're going to see a renewed respect for effective functioning democracies at every level. Aaron raised the prospect of, you know, maybe Trump wanted to just do in the notion of a competent functioning government for all time. If that was the goal, he's really succeeded at the federal level. And I'm reminded of this phrase that Ronald Reagan used that has really been annoying me for about 35 years. Remember when Reagan, I hold on to
this. Yeah, I was going to say, you hold a grudge. Go ahead.
Yeah, and don't get me going on high school. But remember when Reagan said, I'm from the government and I'm here to help? That really was the beginning of suggesting that government is ineffective and dysfunctional. And as a former state and federal employee, I will admit that it's not always the most efficient and it's not always cutting edge, but it's career public servants that are going to save the day here. So I think we walk away with a healthier respect for science and public service.
I want to jump in there if
I
can. I truly believe that this could go either way, Judith, and I certainly agree with you that this is a time when we should be following the science. I think that's why Fauci becomes such an important spokesman, because he keeps saying, got to follow the science, got to follow the facts. On the other hand, at a time of people being scared out of their wits, quite frequently, they will go to religion. And we have seen it in the past, and we may see it again. I hope you're right. I hope that this is going to be a new respect for science, but it may not be. It may be the exact opposite.
But you can respect science and your spiritual journey at the same time. They're
absolutely not
mutually exclusive. Oh, although I will point out Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, worst governor ever, let's do Jeopardy on worst governor. In his long overdue stay-at-home order, he's leaving churches and places
absolutely
of worship and synagogues open. Well, if that's the case, you really better start praying, because
that's exactly
everyone
who
gathers there is in trouble.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Right, got it.
And there it is. Yep.
All right, we have letters. Let's go. We have a lot of them, so I will begin with, go oldest first. Here, Teresa said, if you watch the daily coronavirus briefings of Democrats and some standard Republican governors, we may get an idea of what the 2024 presidential primary will look like. There are some good choices in the mix. Stay healthy, and thank you for all you do. That assumes either a one term for Biden or a Trump reelection, doesn't it? If you're looking at 2024. Crawl to recovery, says Russ. After the initial peak of COVID-19 infections, we will need a means to assess the risk of returning life to normal. Can you imagine your local health department trying to keep track of the thousands who have recovered from the illness or who have a current negative test? Without significant federal help, recovery will be a hopeless task, or we can resign ourselves to a second wave of infections.
A very good letter. And I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, anybody who thinks that if on April 30th or July 30th this thing is over, that it's all over, they're just wrong. It's going to take us, I think, a year, maybe 2 years, maybe more, to get back on our feet, because I think a lot of people will have been conditioned by this in many, many ways.
Absolutely.
I think the governor, you know, the governor has sort of hinted at the importance of the antibody test and how do we phase out of this. And I think he's absolutely right. The real challenge is going to be for businesses that were completely closed, getting reopened, first off, figuring out what are the ground rules. I mean, are we going to limit the number of people that are in a store at one time? If only half of your staff has the antibodies, does that mean you have to keep the other half of the staff home? Or, you know, so I think exactly. There are so many working parts, it's going to be really challenging. But if we come up with a good playbook, I mean, we'll have at least a template for when we are dealing with this again, which I think we it's very likely that we're going to be dealing with, you know, re-outbreaks.
So, hopefully
not as immediate and urgent as now.
Well, that's right. But their vaccines are being developed. But that vaccine that is developed for this disease will not be the cure-all for the next several vaccines, the next several
right.
pandemics that are coming along. So that we should have learned from.
Heather, let me tap into your knowledge here and ask about a large part of the press conference yesterday from the president and from the task force. Ultimately, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, lenders are preparing for a very rocky start to the small business loan program. It's a $349 billion relief program to help small businesses cover their payroll costs for up to 8 weeks. They say it'll be up and running tomorrow, according to Steve Mnuchin. But banks and other lenders that are expected to make the loans, we just heard a report on this on Marketplace at the top of the hour, warned that the relief effort known as the Paycheck Protection Program was going to have a rocky start. What do you make of it?
I mean, I think undoubtedly it's going to be very challenging because it's a new program. I know quite a bit about it. I mean, the SBA loan program, that what they did is they took the existing application and made it super simple. Supposedly, once you make the application, you can get funds today, and it's supposed to be launched today. A lot of people are going to be trying to apply at once. That's going to be very challenging. I think the banks aren't 100% clear on what the expectations are. There's been a lot of the media has actually added to the confusion by reporting things like, well, some people are saying this and other people are saying that, and rather than just taking a look at the actual application and seeing what it says.
My understanding was the application didn't even appear until late yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's true. There's two different programs. There's the EIDL, and then there's the Payroll Protection Act. The Payroll Protection Act application was not available to yesterday, but there are numerous places where you could do your homework if you're a business and get everything you need. The U.S. Chamber has a worksheet. We have one on our the Business Council actually has a COVID-19 resource page that is open to all businesses. And there's a worksheet there that basically tells you what you need to have to apply for the loan. But just like our state unemployment, system, the system crashed a couple times because everyone's trying to get in at once. And just
right.
like, you know, there's no toilet paper everywhere. Everyone is trying to do everything at once. And we don't have that kind of capacity yet. So,
well, you just mentioned something I think we'll just consider a little bit, and that is the competency of the banks. The banks become the middlemen in this. If a bank, is dragging its feet, if it doesn't have the proper personnel, if they don't know what they're doing, one could really be in real trouble if they have chosen the wrong bank.
I mean, I would suggest that people should go to the bank that they work with. There are some rules
sure.
around that anyways, but most businesses have a relationship that they can tap into. And I mean, for at least from my perspective, the banks that that are members of ours are quite competent. And we've been talking about this program for several weeks. So they have been gearing up for it. But, you know, if everyone tries at 11:59 to file their application at once or to get through at once, I think they're going to have to be patient. And that's just, again, most systems aren't built for everyone wanting the same thing at the same time. So we're just going to have to be patient with it. But the program is very generous. It does encourage people to retain staff, which is a pretty important thing right now. And it may soften some of the unemployment numbers moving forward. It does encourage businesses to rehire people, even if they can't come into work. So that's a good thing. There's a lot of good parts about it. My own business, the Business Council, is a C6, and we are completely ineligible and cut out of the program. So that's really unfortunate because, you know, we've been working around the clock trying to get information to businesses and to people to understand what's the best thing to do. Do I furlough people? Do I lay them off? What if someone is sick? What if they're taking care of someone, or if the kids are home, you know, which program do I tap into? And we have all that information. So, but we're, of course, completely ineligible, and we're going to get, you know, we're going to get hit hard because a lot of our members are going to go out of business as a result of this.
I want to, we have to take a break. Sure. So let's take a break. When we come back, I'd also like to talk about the other side of this, of course, which is unemployment and the unemployment numbers, and have Aaron take a look at that for us and tell us what we're dealing with when it comes to the seeing the speed and scale of the job losses that we are. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Shartok, Judith Eng, Heather Brichetti, and Aaron Pacitti. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Hey,
Joe, before we get to the next topic, I just want to quickly build on what Heather was talking about and tell your listeners that there's, in the small business loan program at SBA, there is the opportunity for some nonprofits to also apply for loans. They have to be in existence before March 1st of this year and have fewer than 500 employees. And so there is, and it's the same requirements that Heather discussed, that if you keep staff on payroll between March and June of this year, the loans are forgiven. So, you know, there are a lot of crucially important nonprofits in your listening area, everything from homeless shelters to educational institutions, arts, museums, social services.
Right.
They may not realize that they're also eligible for the SBA 7A loan program.
Alan, you were we were just about to say something when we went to a break.
Well,
you remember?
No, I was very interested in what was said about members of Heather's organization, and that is that, you know, her organization might not be eligible, but they certainly are, and mirroring a good deal of what Judith just said, I know that not-for-profits are eligible if they haven't laid anybody off or if they don't plan
only,
to, if
only,
they're going back.
Only C3 veterans organizations. Every other nonprofit was carved out. Which is a lot. A lot of nonprofits are not organized as C3s or are not veterans organizations.
Well, we've been getting mail from various public radio people who say we are. I'll tell you who isn't. If you're a public radio station that belongs to a university, you're not an individual organization. But I think others are.
Yeah, as long as they're a C3 and have less than 500 employees.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of people.
All right.
Oh, absolutely.
So, Aaron, let's move to you here. We want to talk about the fact that more than 6.6 million people filed new claims for unemployment benefits last week. That, according to the Labor Department, a grim record for the second straight week. That brings the two-week tally to 10 million. What should we make of this?
Oh, boy.
I don't think you need to say anything more. That's it. It's the best commentary. Oh, boy.
The sky is falling. So the first thing to note is that so far, every professional forecast about what has happened in the economy has been far too optimistic and far too rosy. So keep that in mind. When you see the, you know, Congressional Budget Office or forecasters at Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, they have underestimated the size of this for about a month now. So the first thing to understand is that this is not like a natural disaster. Natural disasters affect, you know, specific areas. You know, they're sudden, And I think that's why people are drawing the analogy. But natural disasters only affect, you know, specific cities or parts of states. This is nationwide. So the scale of this is unprecedented. Recessions normally start after some type of economic shock that forces consumers to cut back on consumption, that leads businesses to shed some workers, exacerbating the drop in consumption. And then you have a gradual entry into a recession, and then it bottoms out, and then it recovers once people get confidence back. So what's happening now is nothing like we have seen at any point in economic history. There has never been a recession or economic collapse that has happened this fast and to this degree. You know, the financial crisis in September of 2008, the stock market crash in 1929 looked like, you know, kids play relative to what's happening now. So there's no historical precedent for what's happening now, which means there's no policy template. There's no economic models or forecasting tools that can predict what is going to happen. So economists have no idea about what the consequences are going to be. The spread of the virus and the availability of the vaccine is going to determine how severe and how long this recession will be. So two related things to note. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its March employment report this morning, which showed that the economy lost 701,000 jobs in March, which pushed the unemployment rate up to 4.4%. So those numbers alone have ended the, you know, 9.5-year streak of job creation. And most of those job losses were in leisure and hospitality. And within that, it was primarily food service and drinking establishments. Now, what's important to note is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau conduct the current population survey, which the unemployment numbers are drawn from, on the week that contains the 12th of the month. So this survey was done the second week of March. That's really important because it ignores everything that happened on the last 2 weeks of March, which is the nationwide spread of the virus. For people that are following the unemployment report, you're going to have to wait until early May and early June to really see the explosion. So what I've been focusing on and what Joe alluded to is the weekly report of initial claims for unemployment insurance, meaning workers who have had a job but then lost it and have filed a first-time claim for unemployment. So that's a much more frequent, it's released every Thursday, indicator of what's happening in the economy. And over the last 2 weeks, 10 million people have applied for unemployment insurance. So I did a back of the envelope calculation. If you take that 10 million number and add it to the current stock of unemployed workers, the unemployment rate's actually 10% already. And that's just within 2 weeks. So I wouldn't be surprised if the unemployment rate hits 20 to 30% in April and May. And the important thing to note is that the reason for that skyrocketing in the unemployment rate, and it's worth noting that the highest unemployment rate ever recorded in U.S. economic history was 25% during the Great Depression. So I wouldn't be surprised if we exceed that in the next couple months. Job losses were initially concentrated in tourism, leisure, and hospitality, but what we're starting to see now is the ripple effect, where that's affecting the manufacturing sector, education, retail, business services, and trade. So the ripple effect is going to be the thing that lengthens and deepens the current rate of job loss. Just with the last 2 weeks, we are going to eclipse all of the job losses we experienced during the last recession from 2008 and 2009, so about a two-year recession. We're going to eclipse that job loss total from 2 years and 2 months. So essentially, we're going to see a loss of about 30 million jobs during this, erasing the entire job gains over the last 10 years. So that's my take on this, and it changes.
Well, it's very bright and cheery. We thank you. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not feeling uplifted.
Do you have any good news on this, Heather?
Um, So, I mean, the only hope, and it's not news, but it's hope, is that the incentive for small business, which are the vast majority of employers, I think two thirds of employers are small businesses, that the Payroll Protection Act, once it's kind of worked through the kinks, that people will, some of the folks who have filed already for unemployment will actually find that their employer now wants to put them back on payroll because it will be 100% forgiven. And, you know, given that we were in a historically tight labor market, I think businesses still are going to want to hang on to their people, and especially small businesses. They really care about their employees. They don't want to have to let someone go if they don't have to. It's better for the employee and for the employer if they can keep them on payroll, keep their benefits in place. And that is what the Payroll Protection Act is designed to do. It's very novel. I think this is the first time anything like of this magnitude has been tried. And I guess I'm hopeful that it will have some positive effect on keeping those unemployment numbers from ballooning. And hopefully it'll keep businesses in a mode of thinking we're ready to reopen. I do think there's a limit on eight-week limit on it, but Congress has indicated they will revisit if necessary. My question to Aaron and I just what happens? I mean, at some point, this is a huge debt load on the federal government, and I don't know how you pay for it. I guess you have to figure that out long term.
Just have about 90 seconds. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah. So. That's a good question. How does the federal government pay for all of this? And the answer is essentially borrowing from the public. Right now, the 10-year Treasury bill rate is like 0.6%. So adjusted for inflation, that means, you know, individuals who want to buy government bonds are willing to do so at essentially taking a loss. The federal government could essentially borrow money indefinitely because they have an infinite lifespan, unlike households. And the key is that they need to use that money in two ways. The first one is to stop the bleeding. And I think that's what you see with the $2.2 trillion stimulus, or the $2.2 trillion initial round of stimulus. I think the more important thing to focus on is, given, you know, at an all-time low borrowing cost for the government, how do you use that money to jumpstart growth in the future? One short-term way is invoking the Defense Production Act and getting firms to produce whatever is needed to control the spread of the outbreak. That is in and of itself an employment act. Congress is talking about an infrastructure program. Obviously, that takes time, but infrastructure has one of the best returns on investment of any federal program ever. Job training and essentially having the government act as an employer of last resort, much like they did during the Great Depression. So the answer to Heather's question is the government can borrow money cheaply, and if they use that money to stop the bleeding and then to facilitate long-term growth, we'll be able to pay off all of those individuals and corporations who lent the government money with interest, and then still be able to grow in the long term after that.
All right. Well, we are getting very complete answers here. I thank you for that. Let me take a break. We will get we have a lot of letters, so we'll catch up with those when we come back. And anything anybody else has, we can get to that as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Judith Henk, Heather Bruschetti, and Aaron Pacitti. We thank you all for being here. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Last hour, we were playing Alice Marsalis, who passed away this week because of the coronavirus. And Bucky Pizzarelli also passed away, and playing his music and remembering him this morning in this hour. We have many letters. We're going to get to as many as we can. We begin with Chet, who says, another indication that our president has failed this country in its time of needed medical supplies is the fact that medical supplies have been flown into our country from Russia and China. The supplies from China were transported here by the Patriots team aircraft. Ray just was reporting that story. Sad but grateful for the supplies, says Chet. Then we go to Michael, who says, I want to sincerely thank the hundreds of volunteer health workers for helping New York in this trying time. I want to thank them for choosing science over myth, kindness over contempt, and inclusion over discrimination. And above all, I want to thank them for helping both of my sisters that are New York health workers. Your devotion is nothing short of heroic. Laura asks this question. Where is Melania? Shouldn't she be being best in this time of crisis? Mary has a question for Judith Enck. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's daily average of global atmospheric CO2 is consistently stuck within a few hundredths of a parts per million, 415.6, I believe. Why is it not going down during the pandemic?
Well, it's probably because they're behind on their data collection. There has been some analysis in China. Carbon emissions were significantly reduced. New Jersey is enjoying the cleanest air it has ever experienced in decades. This is not a clean air strategy, obviously. But I do want to point out that while commuting is way down and manufacturing is reduced, there is an improvement in air quality. But as we discussed last week, the Trump administration EPA, Andrew Wheeler, the former coal industry lobbyist who's now the head of EPA, announced last week that they are essentially exercising what's called enforcement discretion, not enforcing federal environmental laws during the pandemic. There's no legal justification for that, and that will result in increased air pollution and increased water pollution. This is absolutely unprecedented, and I really hope our attorney general in New York and Massachusetts and Vermont and other state AGs will go to court to challenge this very irresponsible new EPA policy that says because of the virus, they will not enforce federal environmental regulations at this time if the company, after the fact, can explain why COVID-19 resulted in them violating their permits.
We get this letter from Dara. It is a comment and a question. First, the comment. It infuriates me that Trump refers to Dr. Fauci and Deb. He should be saying Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, shows Trump's opinion of women. The question, and Aaron, I'll let you handle this. Will the $1,200 be taxable income? I've heard both yes and no.
Honestly, I don't know. And I would have to very loudly type on my laptop to find out the answer to that question.
You're not allowed to do that.
So I've seen reports of both. I would be surprised if that counts as taxable income.
All right, we can check.
I can't give a more definitive answer without researching it.
We can do some homework. Let's see. Anne says, please ask Judith to discuss Trump's rollback of laws protecting the environment, allowing automakers to produce cars that are more polluting, corporations, factories to release more toxic waste into waters, atmosphere, etc. Can he do this without approval from House, Senate, anyone's approval? It's all terrifying.
Yes, he can, but he'll likely lose in court. So I just touched on the unprecedented not enforcing federal environmental rules topic. But also the next day, the Trump EPA finalized rolling back the Obama-era fuel efficiency standards, which basically would mean that all of our cars would be more fuel efficient and we wouldn't have to go to the gas station as often if we drive gas cars. So in the middle of the crisis, EPA has announced they have finalized this rule. What's interesting is many of the car companies do not agree with this, and they have developed a side agreement with the state of California to keep producing cleaner cars. The only explanation for the Trump administration doing this and the dreadful anti-environmental policies obviously predated the pandemic, But the only reason to do this is to deliver a win for the oil and gas industry. They want us consumers buying more oil and gas. And I just want to add that President Trump invited the fossil fuel industry CEOs to a meeting in the White House today. My guess is they'll all be flying in on private jets and not social distancing in the White House, because they don't even do that during the news conferences. But Trump took the initiative to invite the oil and gas and coal companies to the White House to talk about how his administration can support the fossil fuel industry during this difficult time of reduced oil production. He is particularly influenced by a guy named Harold Hamm, who is very active with hydrofracking and who's been losing hundreds of millions of dollars because of reduced demand for oil and gas. So my guess is when the Trump show starts late this afternoon at the White House, the replacement for the rallies, he will likely be surrounded. I don't know this for sure, but let's see if he's going to be surrounded by the captains of the fossil fuel industry, who will all praise dear leader.
Could you explain something to me and to everybody else, Judith, and that is how federalism plays into this. So California passes a law and they say, you got to do this. The president rolls back the previous assurances that we weren't going to go back to this anymore. Does California get to call their shots anymore?
Yes.
Yes.
They do, because when the original Clean Air Act was adopted 40 years ago, it had this unique provision that said California can be stronger than the federal government. And then other states like New York can either go with the federal rules or the California rules. So about a dozen states hang together with California, including New York and many northeastern states. I might add that President Trump tried to unravel that and challenge that and pressure the car companies not to go along with California. So far, he has not succeeded. So part of this will be okay for the states who go with the California rules, but that's, you know, less than a dozen states. Well, I'm sure New York will.
Well, then how can the car companies manufacture cars, some for California and those other six states and the rest for everybody else? They can't do that, right?
Not impossible, but very hard. And sometimes it'll be interesting. Will the federal government say you can't produce more fuel efficient cars? I don't think they can do that.
Nah.
And that's why some of the major car companies have bravely ignored the Trump directive. And also, you know, they don't turn on a dime. They're manufacturing for future years. So my guess is many of them are building into their business plan that this national nightmare known as the Trump administration will end in January, and then they'll just go back to requiring cleaner cars.
Back to the letters, we go to Mary, who says, pursuant to the supply chain comments earlier, an emergency disaster is no excuse to destroy the 5% or so of forest and other natural habitats America has left. While America should be more self-sufficient, we need to conserve our resources, our wilderness, and woods. To destroy these is a irreversible step to destroying our own lives. Urban said, go ahead.
I just want to say, and I when I said that we need to have sustainable management of the forest, that's what I meant. I don't mean destroying them, and I certainly would never suggest that, but if we are in a world where other countries are producing paper without environmental rules and without the same kind of labor protections, and we don't recognize that when we make our purchase, then we're supporting them, not the companies that are sustainably managing forests like those in New York, who operate under much stricter rules than paper companies in South America and in China. And by the way, I did look it up. The $1,200, according to The Motley Fool, which was the only place I could find an answer, is not taxable. So take it for what it's worth.
Excellent. Thank you. I get all my best advice from Motley Fool. Go ahead.
Just to chime in, I was looking at the IRS website, and they said more information will be posted on their coronavirus website as it becomes available.
As soon as they find out the answer from the Motley Fools.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let's see. We have letters, and we go to Karen, who says, could you please explain for me in detail how the CDC was rendered ineffective in this pandemic? Anybody want to tackle that one? All right. Hearing nobody, I will just let the question hang in the ever-dwindling wilderness. FYI, I'm an independent massage therapist in Massachusetts, writes Sonia. Unable to work because of the pandemic and was told on a conference call 3 days ago that I will fall under the CARE Act of the stimulus package, but I am not able to file because they do not have systems set up for it. When people like myself and gig workers apply, that number will jump dramatically, says Sonia. This unemployment numbers will continue to be going up. Tricia says, people are dying. I tuned in late. You sound more like Marketplace this morning. Money, money, money. People are dying. The federal government has dropped the ball completely. When are we going to be tested? Right now, we are just told to stay home. No testing, no vaccine on the way, nothing. I'm not blaming you. Just your focus this morning does not address the disease. I will, and not at all defensively, I just will say that we started off this morning by talking about the number of deaths that we have seen in the state, in this country, as well as globally. But I understand the point. We also go to Gene, who says, why hasn't anyone suggested we cut our bloated military budget? We spend more on defense than the next nine nations combined.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I've suggested it 1,000 times on our air. But it's, you know, sort of spitting into the wind, if you know what I mean. And I'm not exactly thinking about spitting.
Yes, I was I was glad you went there, though, Al. That's good. Let's see. Urban says, I think that it was Aaron who said that Trump's failed handling of the pandemic is designed to demonstrate that government doesn't work and that relying on corporations is our only option. Every time someone makes fun of Trump's behavior, I cringe. For my perspective, he is brilliant in his deliberate destruction of our communities and our trust in the democratic institutions designed to help one another. We need to confront this strategy directly.
Well, but I, yeah, but I
like
think,
I said, that
I think,
was,
go ahead, Aaron, and then Judith.
That was just a hypothesis I threw out. And when I try to think about why career Republicans supported Trump and got behind him, that's the only plausible answer I can come up with.
Oh, I got another one. It's called racism. you know, I think it's, we don't want anybody taking away our superiority in this economic system or in this social system. And we're going to have a black and brown population majority soon, and we want to put a stop to that, hence Trump.
Judith, you wanted to say something, and then I have a question for you from listener Sarah. Go ahead.
I think Aaron's being very generous. I think
that
Republicans
is his nature.
Yes, unlike mine. I think Trump is, I think McConnell, who's saying too soon for another stimulus, I think McConnell, it's just all about the judges. Still, and which is still a risk. But if this was actually a thought out strategy, which it never is with Trump, he, you know, shoots from the gut. It is completely failed. I'm still quite stunned by the dwindling but significant number of people who give Trump good marks for handling this crisis.
Yes, but they do. But they do.
Yeah, that's, but I think it's, I know, but it's going down.
Here's the problem. No, it's not. It's going up. And here's the problem. In our next presidential election polling cycle, we are seeing 50-50 between Trump and Biden, assuming Biden is the guy. So I'm thinking that the letter writer, and I say this at great personal risk to myself, I'll be getting letters on this. I think the guy is malicious. He's mean. He's ornery. He's a bad guy. You got that all?
Yes.
But he is, in his own way, brilliant. I think that that is the letter writer isn't subscribing to that, isn't saying, isn't that great? But the guy got himself elected president of the United States one way or another. No easy task against some people who had all kinds of qualifications that he never thought of having. So it's an evil brilliance, but it's a brilliance.
All right, let's go. We have some letters here. Just a reminder, we found out the governor is coming in sometime within the next half hour or so, so we'll be going to that live. We thank you. We want to let you know that that'll be happening. Wait.
You mean here?
No, not you. No. We'll be going to the governor in Albany, and then whenever he calls you, he'll be on with you later.
No, I got a little shocked there. Okay, great.
Okay, you're off the hook for at least a half hour or so. All right, Sarah, Judith, this is for you from listener Sarah, who says, Judith says she hopes the silver lining of this pandemic will be a new respect for science and public service. I'd like to add a renewed respect for unions and unionized employees, to wit, nurses and first responders and teachers. These groups are able to respond as quickly and deftly as they are, in part because these professions have maintained strength and professionalism through the union. So not so much a question, but a comment.
Yeah, could I comment on the comment?
Of course.
Comment on the comment. Absolutely agree with you, Sarah. And I am haunted by my friends and family in the medical profession who are going out every day without adequate, or in some instances, no masks, not enough protective gear. They're putting their life on the line because they're dedicated to healthcare. And it's also the people delivering the mail, the people working in supermarkets, the people working in these Amazon distribution centers who had horrific labor conditions before the virus. I know that some of these institutions cannot secure masks and gowns because of the complete and utter incompetence of the Trump administration. But this is going to be with us a long time. And that's why the Defense Production Act is so important. All of these people need to suit up. We're going to lose a large number of nurses and doctors and janitors and x-ray technicians from our hospitals and visiting nurses associations because they are all getting sick. And then what do we do when you don't have enough healthcare providers? This is one of the worst moments in American history in terms of not taking care of workers, and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, can I add a comment onto the comment I hope the letter writer is correct in that you'll see a new respect for unionized workers, low wage service workers who are being put on the front lines of this, whether they want to or not. There's a huge class bias in terms of the policy response to this and who's allowed to work and, who's allowed to work from home. I hope this does ignite a newfound appreciation for parts of our economy that are otherwise invisible or glossed over. But it's important to remember that we're not looking at a 6-month recovery. We're not looking at a 12-month recovery. We're looking at it becoming worse probably until 2021 before things even start to creep back up and we crawl out of the hole.
And I just want to weigh in a little bit and just say that first, I have huge admiration for the healthcare workers and the teachers who are really, putting themselves on the front lines of this and the teachers, for being creative and figuring out ways to get to their students who, they truly care about. I think every worker deserves protection, but I think what has been missing from this whole conversation is the fact that it wasn't Trump that moved all this manufacturing offshore. This is something that happened over decades, and it really emphasizes and drives home the point of how important it is to maintain the ability to manufacture necessary goods domestically. And there are added benefits like, you know, you have manufacturing jobs domestically, which are high paying jobs and were really the backbone of the middle class for many, many years until manufacturing left the U.S. And it didn't leave the U.S. 100% because of labor costs. It left the U.S. for a lot of reasons, including labor costs, but also including the regulatory environment, including hostility in some instances to manufacturing facilities because people view them as factories, right? And they don't want to have a factory near them. So there's a lot of reasons, but we need to rethink that. We need to think about how can we sustainably make manufacturing come back to the U.S. for those key goods that we might need at the drop of a hat, because it's a lot harder to retrofit a factory that doesn't make this stuff and have it make it on a, you know, on a moment's notice. So, I mean, I think there's some other policy lessons here as well, but I'll go back to, I applaud the healthcare workers and the teachers and everyone who has, and the grocery store workers. And I saw for the first time in the grocery store, a shield at the checkout between the cashier and the customer. So we're all going to have to make changes, but we also have to think about how do we make our economy strong and bring back some of this essential manufacturing.
All right.
So should we repeal NAFTA? That is my question.
It's a very big question before we have to go to a break, but go ahead.
I would say no to that, but Aaron is more of an expert. But I think the fact that I'm asking for key stuff to be repatriated doesn't mean we're still not going to want to export stuff, and having trade agreements is pretty important.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from Capital Roots, working year-round to provide nourishment, community, and a sense of belonging for individuals who call the Capital Region home. CapitalRoots.org to learn more. And CNH Architects, working with residential clients throughout the Berkshires and Hudson Valley to create a legacy of sustainable architecture designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, practicing aesthetic medicine and cosmetic plastic surgery, working to help people improve their confidence and well-being. CAPEKplasticsurgery.com, 518-786-1700.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Heather Bracetti, and Aaron Pacitti. I was trying to say Heather and Aaron at the same time. It didn't work. Heather Bracetti and Aaron Pacitti, and we thank you, panel at WAMC.org. Unless anybody wants to comment on what we just went to, I have letters.
Letters.
Okay.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yes.
I don't think repealing NAFTA makes sense. Because like Heather said, you know, part of trade agreements are to provide export markets as well as access to imported goods, whether they be finished consumer goods or raw materials for U.S. businesses. But I do think it's important that, and I really hope that this prompts a radical rethinking of international trade policy. And that goes well beyond low-wage labor. Like Heather said, you know, remember that it was President Clinton who granted China permanent normal trading relations, which essentially opened the floodgates legally for U.S. firms to relocate production there. I think what Heather was implying, and this has kind of become a dirty word, is some form of industrial policy, some form of coherent economic policy that is, you know, the federal government sets the rules and sets the boundaries and provides funding when necessary, so that the U.S. economy can flourish, whether it's, you know, increasing manufacturing in the U.S. or, you know, the provision of strategic goods. That needs to be rethought. And I really hope that this happens.
But I just want to point out, lest that people think that I'm too critical of Trump, this door was opened wide by Bill Clinton, and the drive toward economic globalization. You know, the chickens are coming home to roost, and NAFTA is a big part of it, because regardless of the very weak side agreements on labor protections and environmental protections, this became a race to the bottom. And then additional practices that you just keep a supply of what you absolutely need in the near term, and the failure of the federal government to maintain adequate supplies of vital agreement. I mean, I think long-term international trade agreements and globalization need to be part of this discussion on how we avoid the situation from repeating itself.
All right, let's go to letters. And Linda writes in and says, I've learned that the maternity ward staff at a local Albany hospital are not allowed to wear masks per notice from hospital administrators. I'm aware of PPE shortages and critical care needs, but the potential exposure to mom, baby, and birthing partner is concerning. I've made masks for family members, and I know many others are doing the same for family and organizations. Will our hospitals accept homemade masks? What can we do? I know that was a story that was done both on NPR and Marketplace this morning, of hospitals are kind of dealing with that very issue as to whether they accept those or not.
There's a good website on this, Joe. GetUsPPE.org. GetUsPPE.org. That's what we're reduced to, making stuff at home and seeing if hospitals and nurses will accept it.
And again, I will note that there is a great pattern that the New York Times put up on their page. So if you're looking, if you're sewing and you're so inclined, there you go. Let's go over to this note from Karen. Please discuss what steps the average citizen can take to express outrage about how the federal government has handled this pandemic. We need a massive response. I continue to call my representatives. I write letters. I engage and get out the vote writing to citizens across the country. But I feel like there needs to be a huge response from the public. What to do? Distressed, sad, and worried about our democracy. Thanks for the show.
Vote.
Well, she's working on the vote part.
But in addition to voting, we all need to be actively engaged every day in making sure that Trump is not reelected. That is the single most important thing. If there is a Trump second term, we never, ever get out of this.
I agree.
All right. We go to Joe, listener Joe, who says, I think it is valiant that we continue to call Trump a liar, even though we know it will not cause him to change. Remember the 17,000 or so lies he's told officially started on day one. He said, my inauguration crowds were the biggest in history, .. For my money, I would like to see White House reporters decide to make every question to his face about his blatant, provable lies.
Well, remember, he also said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not be held accountable.
Well, that wasn't a lie.
But
he's killing so many more than one person on Fifth Avenue.
I get it.
The 4-H camp I attended in Speculator, New York, was a former CCC camp. I wonder if the government will open something on that idea to get people back to work, like after the Depression. Will the government begin a draft to put people to work on farms? If the economy completely fails, will we use vouchers rather than money? Perhaps county chambers of commerce should begin a webpage listing a barter exchange program for business as well as individuals, so that small communities can begin to help themselves. That from Laura.
Let's just remember that a few weeks ago, nobody could find anybody to work in their stores or in their places. I mean, I'm not arguing that that was good or bad. I'm just simply saying that's the way that it was, right, Heather? I mean, just a few weeks
ago. Yeah, I mean, the workforce, the market was so tight that you saw people essentially trying to recruit from other firms. There's, you know, theft going on. Poaching, I guess, is a nicer word. But I was happy to hear the reference to county chambers of commerce, because I think right now the chambers of commerce are providing information to small businesses and independent contractors about what to do and how to navigate this. And I'll just go back to my point. They're not eligible for any of this emergency funding. So I just make sure people continue to support them.
We go to this lady, We go to this letter from Jerry, who says, what regulations are in place to prevent small business owners pocketing some or all of the loan rather than passing it on to the workers?
There's requirements in the loan for it to be forgiven, right? So it's a loan that gets forgiven if you maintain your payroll. There is a little bit of wiggle room that would accommodate overhead as well, because it acknowledges that payroll isn't the only cost of these businesses. And it is capped up to a certain amount of income. And so there are some rules in place to try and ensure that it doesn't just go in their pocket. If they lay people off, it will not be forgiven. They'll have to pay it back.
Daisy writes, go ahead, Aaron.
I just want to add on to that. In addition to the Payroll Protection Act, which Heather has talked about, there's also the seed money provided by the Treasury Department to the Federal Reserve to essentially loan directly to corporations and backstop certain loans. So it's not just this, $350 billion package. There's another $450 billion the Treasury has allocated primarily to the Federal Reserve for them to backstop and guarantee loans in addition to loaning directly to businesses. So it is more than just the small business lending that's happening.
All right.
There's actually provisions in that as well that didn't exist in prior stimulus that limit the ability of companies to do stock buybacks. And there will be a review to make sure that some of the funding it doesn't get used to do high bonuses. I mean, I think that's all in development and we'll see how that works. But there has been some recognition that past stimulus maybe wasn't used in a way that it was intended.
All right, let's try to get as many letters here as we can. Daisy says, how about we restore the marginal tax rate to pre-Reagan days, 70% if we are so worried about debt? Jeff is taking us to task for stop calling the CARES Act a stimulus package. Call it what it is, disaster relief. Also, we go to Bill, who says, thanks to Aaron for his insightful and blunt analysis of the looming economic consequences as we face as a result of this pandemic. It's certainly the polar opposite of the inane comments from the president's quote-unquote gut. Jude says, it seems like an advantageous maneuver in the near future would be to legalize the recreational use of marijuana, developing tax revenue, and developing new jobs, businesses, and dispensaries and farms. This is an unprecedented economic meltdown. Alan, you have some thoughts on that?
I do. I've been questioning the governor about that for months and months and months. It makes great sense. Apparently, the holdup is with Speaker Carl Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, who wants to make sure that the money that comes in is going to go to the people who have been suffering within some of the marginalized districts. And that's a very tough one to achieve. And how you do that, I don't know. But it is a disgrace that this is not in the budget this time, because, as you know, this was his last best chance to make it happen if he really wants it to happen. And I have questioned that motivation with him a number of times.
All right. We have time for one more letter. It is from Jeffrey, who says it's unrealistic that we will be able to manufacture the needed items. No one will buy them due to their cost. All we need to do is procure a vast stockpile of at least 6 months' supply from other nations. That from Jeffrey. I want to thank the whole panel. Again, we have the governor coming up, and we want to get to that. We welcome your letters, of course, always, panel at WAMC.org. And my thanks to our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Heather Bruschetti, and Aaron Pasitti. Thank you all very much. Have a beautiful weekend. Be well.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. We'll be back right after this.